Good morning. Iranians say Iran alone will determine how the Strait of Hormuz reopens. It opposed a UN plan and started a new round of attacks. Is the ceasefire still on? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Nuclear gobstoppers are powering the next generation of reactors. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. They're part of a federal pilot program that's running at super speed because the Trump administration made it easier to convince regulators. Also, there are new limits on how much graduate students can borrow. Will it make grad school cheaper? And Maroon 5's PJ Morton splits his new double album between R&B and gospel. It's called Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. It's Monday, June 29th. On this day in 1958, a 17-year-old Pelé helped Brazil win its first World Cup. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Venezuela's government says at least 1,450 people have been killed in last week's double earthquakes. Tens of thousands of others are missing. Large buildings have collapsed, and there's a lot of rubble. Rescue teams are trying to find people who are still trapped. NPR's Ada Peralta is in Caracas, the Venezuelan capital.
What I saw was just a couple of dozen family members climbing through the rubble, and they were just picking random places to dig. And then at times the smell of death would get stronger and they would dig faster. And I mean, look, there are helicopters in the air and there's backhoes, and the Venezuelan government has deployed the military and the police, and a bunch of foreign countries have sent rescue crews here, but there's just not enough of them.
NPR's Ada Peralta in Caracas. Russian President Vladimir Putin says his forces will fight on in Ukraine. Putin is reacting to a Ukrainian offer for both sides to end long-range strikes. NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
In an interview on state television, Putin painted the Ukrainian proposal to limit attacks as one of desperation, saying Kyiv needed to reinforce depleted troops along the front. Russia's military, Putin said, was finally on the verge of taking full control of four regions of Ukraine the Kremlin initially claimed to annex back in 2022. To a degree, Putin acknowledged the toll of Ukrainian drone attacks on Russia's energy infrastructure. Despite nationwide gas shortages, Putin insisted the situation was far from critical. He also said Russia was working to improve its air defense systems against drone attacks, even as Ukraine carried out weekend strikes on a key defense factory and several oil refineries. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Extreme heat will cover a majority of the U.S. through the July 4th weekend. NPR's Chandelise Duster has more on the heat wave that will affect millions.
The National Weather Service says several days of dangerous heat will linger across the U.S. through the July 4th holiday weekend. Parts of Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas are under extreme heat warnings. High temperatures in the 90s to low 100s combined with humidity can make temperatures feel like 115 degrees. National Weather Service forecaster Brian Putnam says those gathering outdoors should remain cautious at night because there may be little relief from the heat.
We're particularly concerned just with the higher amount of outdoor activity. People just want to get out and celebrate, and it's going to be potentially dangerous. It's a significant heat wave.
Officials are warning people to limit time outdoors, stay hydrated, and remain in air-conditioned areas. Chandelise Duster, NPR News.
Meanwhile, there are scores of wildfires, mostly burning in the West. Several blazes have limited or no containment. Three Colorado firefighters were killed Saturday as they worked on a blaze near the border with Utah. This is NPR. President Trump has picked a former Oklahoma State Trooper as his nominee to lead Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Lance Schroyer is a top advisor to Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen. The agency says Schroyer is already overseeing coordination of immigration enforcement. New federal data show that 5 million people have dropped their insurance under healthcare.gov. This comes after premium costs doubled on average this year for enrollees. The World Cup has now arrived at the knockout stage. Canada began yesterday by defeating South Africa 2-1. And NPR's Jasmine Garst explains any team that loses goes home.
From here on out, there is no such thing as a game ending in a draw. If after a 90-minute game the teams are even, they play an extra 30 minutes. If they're still tied after that, the game goes to penalties. And if after all that they are still drawn, it becomes sudden death. If Team A misses a penalty and Team B makes the next one, Team B gets to stay. Here is Team USA striker Folarin Balogun talking about what this moment means.
It's crunch time, you know, it's knockout football, and you know, you lose, you go home. So, you know, this is the stage where, in my opinion, you know, the big players step forward.
31 teams are still left, including the USA, who plays Bosnia-Herzegovina on Wednesday. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, Houston.
There are three World Cup games set for today. Brazil plays Japan, Germany will play Paraguay, and Morocco will play the Netherlands. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Holy cow, you guys, the World Cup is starting, and it's like the biggest nightmare and the most amazing thing all mashed together in one six-week-long tournament. I'll let you guys jump in here a second, but I just got to get some stuff out of my brainium right now.
Let it rip. Unleash.
Well, this is the biggest event in the world. They compare every day of the World Cup to a Super Bowl, where our whole country kind of comes to a stop and people that don't even care about the sport gather in people's homes and have food and blah, blah, blah. That is every day. So this World Cup is the first one to be co-hosted by three countries, Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. And boy, are there a lot of problems.
Tune in Fridays at 8:40 with DJ Dang for Football is Life. We're learning all about this year's World Cup here on People Powered KAXE.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The United States and Iran spent another weekend of their ceasefire not ceasing fire.
The latest exchange of missiles began in the Strait of Hormuz. Iranians say Iran alone has control. Iran opposed a UN-backed plan, fired on ships, starting a whole new round of attacks with the U.S. The latest missiles yesterday went after U.S. bases in Kuwait and Bahrain.
In a moment, we'll hear from Jake Sullivan, former U.S. National Security Advisor with long experience with Iran. We begin with NPR's Kerry Khan, who's in Tel Aviv. Hi there, Kerry.
Hi.
Okay, I just got to ask, are the ceasefire peace talks, the continuing peace talks, still on?
We believe so. A senior U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive negotiations told NPR last night that, quote, nothing has been canceled and talks are on track for the coming days. The Associated Press is reporting that Pakistan, a key mediator, says talks will resume Tuesday.
And yet we did have this exchange of fire. What happened over the weekend?
In recent days, Iran struck two ships attempting passage through the Strait of Hormuz. These ships were going through this newly coordinated route that hugged the coast of Oman, which shares part of the strait with Iran. Last week, the UN's International Maritime Organization and Oman set up this route. Iran says it is a violation of the preliminary plan for permanent peace. After Iran's attack on the first ship, the U.S. then struck multiple drone, missile, and radar sites in Iran. Then Iran fired into Bahrain and Kuwait in retaliation.
Okay, if Iran is striking ships on their way through the strait, is the strait open?
Well, we'll see. Traffic did drop over the weekend, according to monitoring groups. But the conflict over who controls the Strait of Hormuz continues. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was just in the region and told Gulf allies it will remain open. But yesterday, Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, was adamant. He said any alternative or, quote, separate arrangements for the strait will lead to complications.
مسئولیت این ترتیبات با جمهوری اسلامی ایران هست.
The responsibility for these arrangements lies with Iran and no other entity or country, he said.
Okay, so we've got two major sticking points in negotiations. One we've just been discussing, the Strait of Hormuz. The other is Lebanon, where Israeli troops remain in the southern part of the country, and they say they're going to stay there. But Israel did reach an agreement with Lebanon's government. What's going on there?
Yes, a deal was reached between the U.S., Israel, and the Lebanese government late Friday. Israel says it's historic, with the Lebanese army agreeing to disarm Hezbollah. Hezbollah, however, was not part of those talks, and its leader over the weekend condemned the deal and demanded Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon. Last night, I spoke with Ofir Falk. He's the foreign affairs advisor to Israel's prime minister, and I asked him repeatedly, how is this deal going to work without Hezbollah signing on and giving the Lebanese army's poor track record? And here's what he said.
There's only going to be one weapon in Lebanon, and it's going to be the Lebanese government. It's historic that they recognize Israel's sovereignty, and they seek peace with Israel. They're saying that straight out.
He said Israel has laid the path for the Lebanese army by greatly degrading Hezbollah's military might. But, Steve, fighting continued over the weekend, too. Despite the deal, authorities in Lebanon and Israel say there were multiple deaths in Lebanon and one Israeli soldier was killed.
Carrie, thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Carrie Khan in Tel Aviv.
Let's get more insights into these U.S.-Iran negotiations with Jake Sullivan. He served as President Biden's national security advisor, and he was instrumental in negotiating the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in the Obama administration. Jake, good morning and welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So it feels like we keep seeing attempts at getting to a ceasefire or agreements for a ceasefire that are just not ceasefires, right? They're filled with threats from the U.S., counter threats from Iran, and then the U.S. and Iran trading actual fire. Is this just the new normal?
I'm afraid it may be. Neither side wants to go back to full-scale war. They both want to keep a lid on this escalation. But Iran wants to show that it has control of the Strait of Hormuz, and the United States doesn't want Iran to flaunt that, doesn't want that to become too apparent to the world, because that's egg on the face of the president and the administration. So if Iran does too much publicly to demonstrate it has control, the U.S. feels it has to respond. But at the end of the day, both sides win talks. They want to keep the process moving, and they don't want to go back to war. So I think we will see these flare-ups, and then we will see de-escalation and a return to the table. And I think that is, as you put it, the new normal.
And so right now, what you think we're seeing is a flare-up, but they won't kill negotiations?
Look, for Iran, continuing these negotiations means continuing to get access to a very large financial windfall. And for the United States, continuing the negotiations means they don't get stuck in a strategic dilemma of having to restart a war that doesn't seem to have an end. So I do think there's a lot of incentive for them to avoid having this spin entirely out of control. But there still isn't a real meeting of the minds about what the deal is. So the flare-up over the weekend, I think we'll see something like it going forward, but we'll also see both sides scrambling to try to keep it from becoming the war that we saw a couple of months ago. Both sides are gonna want to try as much as possible to keep the ceasefire in place, even though from time to time we will see these kinds of strikes.
And a financial windfall, you're referring to possible sanctions relief that would come out of these negotiations.
Yes, a combination of being allowed to sell their oil on the open market and get money for that, and also having their assets that are frozen in other countries unfrozen so that they can get access to tens of billions of dollars. That's what the United States committed to giving Iran in return for opening the strait.
The latest cycle unfolded with Iran attacking ships in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran's government insists it was given control of the strait in the memorandum of understanding signed by Tehran and the Trump administration. Let's hear what Trump's UN ambassador Mike Waltz said on Fox News Sunday.
If the Iranian regime thinks for a second that President Trump is going to stand by, while Iran continues to attack international shipping without a response, or our bases without a response, they're sadly mistaken.
Now, this gets at something you said earlier about the administration not wanting Iran to flaunt that it has control. Does this continued battle for control of the strait surprise you, though, that Iran has such control?
Not really. The memorandum of understanding is quite clear that for 60 days, Iran can't charge tolls or fees. But after 60 days, the memorandum seems to suggest that Iran can impose some kind of arrangement to make ships going through the strait pay it some compensation. So the memorandum does envision that Iran will have a degree of jurisdiction or control over the strait. But I think the Trump administration wants to keep that as ambiguous as possible, wants to downplay that because obviously they see that as a setback because before this war started, Iran didn't have control of the strait. But I also think that Iran is going to want to play this carefully too, so that it doesn't lose the benefits that come from being in this memorandum. And that's why my expectation is that there will be a continued testing on both sides, a jockeying on both sides, but with each side ultimately wanting to stay at the table.
Is there a point where regional powers will just get frustrated with this process? I mean, they're the ones that are dealing with missile fire from Iran, places like Kuwait and Bahrain most recently. I mean, is there a world where the U.S. gets sidelined out of the process and these countries come to a regional security framework on their own?
I think we're rapidly approaching that point. And my expectation is that each of those countries are going to be quietly trying to cut their own deal with Iran to get their own ships through and also to try to secure a more sustainable opening of the strait so that we don't see it kind of open then close, then open then close. And my guess is those kinds of talks are happening now. I don't think it will completely sideline the United States because obviously we are there with a lot of firepower and the capacity to strike Iran. But I do think it will mean that the U.S. ends up with less influence and the Gulf states working with Iran will ultimately determine the future here.
Jake Sullivan was National Security Advisor in the Biden administration and a negotiator of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Thank you for your time and your insights.
Thanks for having me.
A heat wave that has shattered records and killed hundreds across Western Europe is now rolling eastward into Lithuania, Poland, and Ukraine. It remains very hot in Rome, which is where we find reporter Megan Williams.
Here in Rome, it's not the grand tourist fountains that locals flock to in this heat. It's these smaller ones in neighborhoods across the city, the iron street corner spigots that run cold all day, all year. Italy has been sweltering for weeks, with temperatures reaching 104. France recorded its hottest day ever, one town hitting 111 degrees. Spain topped 113, and Britain issued its highest level heat alert. What scientists once predicted is now a reality. Europe is warming faster than any other inhabited continent, and heat waves like this are the new normal. Across Europe, more than 300 people have died since last week, many drowning as they sought relief in rivers and lakes. Now that heat dome is rolling east. In Vilnius, Lithuania, which shattered its all-time June record Sunday at 97 degrees, people stroll under umbrellas and line up for ice cream.
I will definitely go to work, as I usually work from home. I don't have AC at home, and my work office has AC, so I definitely go in.
Says finance compliance worker Aurelia Braze. Poland and the Czech Republic both set all-time temperature records this week. But further east, in Ukraine, the heat compounds a summer already strained by war. In Kyiv, families are cooling off at the Dnipro River beaches, for most, the only option. I know the city where the shelters are. Going somewhere unfamiliar would be more stressful than staying in Kyiv, said resident Olena Klemenko. For NPR News, I'm Megan Williams in Rome.
This is NPR News.
Minutes after 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr.
Coming up at 6:30, we're going to hear Minnesota Native News. This week, a conversation with Ashley Cornforth about the IndigiFit Kids Coaching Academy. And just after 7 o'clock, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at atchisontire.com. We also thank the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the 2026 Bush Fellows, leaders working to make the region better for everyone. More information online at bushfoundation.org. We have a chance of showers and thunderstorms today and warm temperatures, highs in the upper 80s to low 90s, breezy southeast winds up to 30 miles per hour. Chance of showers and thunderstorms continues tonight with lows in the upper 60s and tomorrow warm once again with highs in the upper 80s to low 90s. You can answer our question of the week. What's a 4th of July tradition you look forward to every year? Text us at 218-326-1234. And you can look for KAXC's Guide to the 4th Up North at KAXC.org. You'll find a complete list of area fireworks, parades, and more.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from DuckDuckGo, who believes AI should be useful, private, and optional. DuckDuckGo offers controls to turn AI on or off. Learn more at DuckDuckGo.com. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From strawberry.me, whose career coaches offer professional support to help people get unstuck, gain clarity, and move forward, whether advancing in a current role or choosing a new direction altogether. More at strawberry.me/public. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. How many people slink into church on Sunday morning after getting a little wild on Saturday night? That you? Don't worry. I'm sure it's all forgiven. With that in mind, singer PJ Morton splits his latest collection of songs, one half sacred, one half secular. Or better yet, one for the party.
I'm so sorry, you know that I need you.
And one for the penance.
Oh, bless his name. Oh, bless his name.
His new double album is called Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. PJ Morton, welcome to the show.
Oh, yeah, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
PJ, I'm sure there's going to be some people that are going to think, well, you know what? Those two sides should not coexist, ever.
Right?
So
right.
Who made that rule? I mean, where did that rule come from?
I don't know, man. I'm here to break it.
No matter how hard you try,
no matter how hard you try,
you can't have control.
You can't have control.
Yes, I promise you.
This has kind of been, you know, a lifelong journey for me, growing up a preacher's kid and hearing you about the secular, you know, devil's music and whatnot. And as I grew up and fell in love with Stevie Wonder and Al Green and Donny Hathaway, it started to get confusing. My dad even said, you know, I wasn't listening to Amazing Grace when I was courting your mother, you know. And so love is biblical, you know.
Yeah. Saturday and Sunday, to me, I think always go together. And the reason why is because I had an uncle, PJ, who would go out mm-hmm. on Saturday night and he'd come home like at 5 a.m. on Sunday, right? But he mm-hmm. would be ready to go to church right at 8:00, like without
yeah.
fail. And one time after Man. Years, I'd ask him, why do you even go to church on Sundays anymore? And he would tell me this. He would say it in Spanish. ¿Cómo voy a ser perdonado por lo que hice el sábado si no voy a la iglesia el domingo? Which means, how am I going to get forgiven for what I did Saturday if I don't go to church on Sunday? So to me, I think it makes sense that both Saturday and Sunday are mixed together in the way you did it.
Yeah. But for me, it's been the Black experience to work hard all week. A lot of times on a job you don't even want to be at, right? And then Saturday, you decompress. But then you always culturally needed that Sunday for community and, you know, most times church to, you know, recharge for that week that's coming again. So I just think they naturally roll together.
Yeah. My whole life. And you may not come exactly when I like.
So I'm wondering, you said you're a preacher's son. I mean, was there any, I mean, have you felt it in your life? Like the pressure not to like escape those bounds in a way?
I was a believer and I was writing gospel music. Gospel music gave me my start as a songwriter and a producer. But I knew as an artist, I didn't want to be a gospel artist. First, I didn't want to be a preacher. So like that was that was some pushback in the house. I'm like, Dad, I don't want to follow in your footsteps. I don't want to be a pastor. And then I'm like, you know, I don't even want to sing gospel music. Wow. And then so like any parents, I was probably 13, you know, 14. Any parents, they just thought I was a preacher's kid rebelling. But I think the more they saw like having success in R&B music, of course, and pop music with Maroon 5, they became my number one supporters after that.
How do you muster up that courage to tell your preacher father that you don't want to be a preacher and you don't want to sing gospel music? I mean, man.
That's why it's no question in my mind that this was purpose for me, you know, like, because I was trying my best to just please him, you know, do Christian records, do gospel records. And I had gotten to the end of that, like, okay, I can't fake anymore. And I knew in myself, like, I'm going to do this regardless of whether he approves or not. But man, it would be good if he approved, you know? So for me to do that, I knew it was a real thing for me. And probably that was probably signal to him, like, oh, if he's doing this, he must, this must be serious. So let me listen.
My mama told me, keep him out your business. I tried my best to keep it all between us. Cause everybody don't wanna see you happy. Now it's not all it's cracked up to be without me.
You're not just a solo artist. You mentioned Maroon 5.
Yeah.
You know, you're actually, we caught you while you're on tour with them right now.
That's right.
I've seen a Maroon 5 show, and it can get a little sexually charged. I mean, sometimes. I mean,
yeah.
You know, fans go a little crazy for Adam Levine. I mean, do you have to go find a church somewhere after some of those shows?
Yeah. No, man. I mean, sex isn't bad. You know, first of all, yeah, there are some sexual songs. I mean, I got here some way. But for me, it's also my job. I'm a musician, you know. Yeah. I think, you know, I've never let myself be boxed in by that. And those Maroon 5 shows are amazing. Those are my brothers, man, and I feel just fine after those shows. Yeah.
I read that you were searching for why I wanted to make music this time around when it comes to this double album. So, PJ, a bit of a blunt question here. Mm-hmm. Isn't making music what you do? And if it is, why were you searching?
Up to this point, you know, I don't know how anybody else does it, but up to this point, I'm literally inspired to make things. You know, like, I have to be inspired, and I think once you get to album 10, you know, not including Maroon albums, you know, and all these other things I worked on. I watched that Billy Joel doc, you know, when he said, look, I've written everything. Like, I don't know what to say. And he stopped writing lyrics. You know, I think I'm not quite at that point. But for me, it still has to be for a reason, because it's hard out here. You know, like, you got to really work hard if you want people to hear your music, if you want to get, especially today, algorithms you're fighting against. So it's really got to be worth it for me. It's got to, like, be for a reason.
I take back everything I said.
That's PJ Morton. His new double album is called Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. PJ, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
But I've been a mess since you left. Yes, I must confess, I've been a mess.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration has made massive cuts to research at labs and universities in the United States. Now, a growing number of scientists are looking elsewhere for work.
When I went on the job market, I started looking around overseas.
I'm Scott Detrow. How the Trump administration may be causing a brain drain in the U.S. on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, coming up at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE. Your local host will be Andrew DeZingle. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to have Minnesota Native News and then Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. We're going to hear how Blue Jays have played a part in Laura's family life for decades. And then we've got in a story from Sam Miltich, noted jazz musician, from a live Stay Human storytelling event. Mostly cloudy today with a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly this afternoon. Highs 85 to 92 with southeast winds, 5 to 15 gusting higher. Showers and thunderstorms likely tonight with lows in the low to mid 60s. And tomorrow, sunny. Highs in the mid to upper 80s with breezy southwest wind. Taking a look at our current temperatures, it is 65 in Hibbing, 69 in Brainerd, 67 in Bagley and Bemidji. It's time for Minnesota Native News.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News. I'm Murray Rock. This week, we look back at producer Dan Ninham's conversation with Ashley Cornforth about the coaching academy that was held in partnership with the Nota Begay Foundation, or NB3, the goals of Indigifit Kids, and what are some of the other programs and events the campaign is focusing on this year.
I'm Ashley Cornforth, Secretary Treasurer for the Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux community, here to talk about IndigiFit Kids, the SMSC's three-year, $6 million philanthropic campaign to improve the physical fitness and mental wellness of Native youth in Minnesota, which is growing the next generation of Indigenous leaders, growing the next generation of healthy, fit Native youth, and creating healthy Natives in general, creating a healthy Native population. Our Native youth face so many health disparities right now, and so we're trying to give them more access and more resources just with the goals of like living healthy lives. So working with MB3 Academy, Nota Begay the Third Foundation, we really created this academy to do a program in which we could empower the adults who work with our youth and empower the adults who are interacting one-on-one so that they can help understand some of the disparities that are existing within our Native youth and help bridge the gap between that physical fitness element and the world in which the youth kind of live in right now.
We'd like you to touch on what's happening currently and also what are you looking for the future?
Yeah, we have a lot of different partnerships happening. We partnered with Kaboom, who creates play spaces throughout the United States. So we're hopeful to get started a new play space out in 2026, either in an urban Native population or within on a tribal reservation. Going forward, we're obviously excited to have a lot of IndigiFit Kids projects in the works. We're working with a lot of great partners. Live More, Screen Less. We're trying to do a digital wellness survey and understanding to see what the impacts of screens are on our Native youth, because we think that's an area that isn't really being researched and understood right now. So we're hopeful to kind of spend some attention and light on expanding that research. So look for more to come on that. We're hopeful to start some running clubs for Native girls through our partnership with Girls on the Run Minnesota. They do a great program with youth right now, and we're hoping that we can really highlight and focus our Native youth through running. We obviously have other great partnerships. We work with the Minnesota Vikings. They're hosting the Native All-American football game. We're going to be a big part of that, and so we're hopeful to just keep going with our partnerships and keep going with the research work that's being done alongside of it.
So we're curious on your reach. Are you reaching all the reservation communities as well as the urban, other than just the Twin Cities? I mean, Duluth and other areas as well. How far are you expanding your programming?
Yeah, definitely. We're working with all 11 tribes in Minnesota. We have great relationships with all 11 tribes in Minnesota already, just as the Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux community. And so we're always engaged and always talking with them. Specifically, we are doing a place-based research study with Kaboom. They went out to all tribal or throughout most of Minnesota to try and understand what needs are out there. And then within the urban areas, we are working with the population within Minneapolis, a lot of the organizations down here. And we just talked about a proposal that would hopefully be reaching Duluth. We're trying to expand our outreach, get through the entire state of Minnesota, make sure that we're touching all Native youth in Minnesota so that there's no stone left unturned, and we're highlighting as many Native youth as possible. If you'd like to get updates or stay up to date on all of our things, that exciting things that we have happening in 2026, please go to indigifitkids.org or check us out on Instagram and digifitkids.
That's all for this week's episode. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities right here on Minnesota Native News.
Listen to Minnesota Native News online anytime at minnesotanativenews.org. You can also listen to us on demand on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, PRX, and Podchaser.
Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
You can find more at minnesotanativenews.org. It is 6:36. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Heidi Holton.
It's a steamy morning on this June 29th. We have one day of June left, right?
Yeah, after today.
That's right. We're in the 4th of July week. Kind of typical to be a little bit steamy, unlike the... It's been cooler for this summer. So, you know, if you're somebody who needs air conditioning, turn that on. It's a good thing.
It's the steamy weather. And that also means chance of thunderstorms kind of off and on throughout the week, it seems.
So. Yeah, a little bit of, I think it was mist or humidity as I drove in. I needed windshield wipers a little bit, but looking like 85 to 92 for our day today.
Yeah, and we do have that chance of showers and thunderstorms kind of mostly this afternoon, it looks like. But just with this weather, those storms could kind of just pop up.
Yeah. Our thanks goes out this morning to Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving the Northland for over 25 years on the Beltline in Hibbing. Their service center provides regular maintenance and major auto repairs weekdays from 7:30 to 5:30. More details online, hibbingchrysler.us.
Coming up at 7 this morning, we have a special Up North report with our report from Minnesota intern, Erin Bowman. She's going to let us know about a pizza garden in Deer River. Some kids are involved in that. But first, we're going to hear Laura Erickson speaking for the birds, telling us about how blue jays have been a part of her family for decades.
Ever since I started producing For the Birds in 1986, I've always called any month with a blue moon National Blue Jay Awareness Month. Last month qualified because there were two full moons, but between all the preparations and travel involved in giving talks at birding events in Ohio and Wisconsin, and then my daughter's stem cell harvest at the Mayo, National Blue Jay Awareness Month entirely slipped my mind. This month, I've inadvertently been making up for lost time because I decided to focus on my top 10 list, and the blue jay has for over half a century held the number one or number two position. I'm especially fond of them because they are so deeply embedded into my family life, going all the way back to when my children were little. While my not-quite-one-year-old daughter Katie still had a one-word vocabulary, Mama, and was just starting to pull herself up to stand, she gravitated to the picture window in our living room. That windowsill was exactly the right height for her to grab. Meanwhile, a pair of blue jays had figured out that I was giving peanuts to some tame squirrels on our front porch, right outside Katie's picture window. The squirrels usually ate the peanuts right away, but sometimes buried one or two. As soon as a squirrel tucked a peanut somewhere and ran off, one of the blue jays would drop down, dig it out, and fly away. When I noticed this, I started leaving peanuts out on the flat porch railing, and soon the birds started skipping the middleman. At first, they would not fly to the porch until I went inside, but one day the braver member of the pair started flying in and grabbing the peanut if I stepped far enough back from the railing. By the time the more timid Jay started coming in while I was still on the porch, the braver Jay was taking the peanuts out of my hand. As long as I held very still with my arms stretched out as far from my face as possible. The second Jay never felt comfortable with that. To entice that one to the porch, I always had to step way back from the railing, and if I made any unexpected movement, that Jay hightailed it back to the safety of the maple tree. One time I sneezed right as it alighted on the porch railing, and it flew off, not returning for several days. My Katie loved watching these big, colorful birds at close range, so when I asked her if she wanted to see the blue jays, she'd crawl straight to the living room window saying, "Boo Jay." When my first book came out in 1994, I scraped up the $100 for a personalized license plate memorializing Katie's second word. That was a one-time expense. 32 years later, my license plate still reads Boujay. And now that Minnesota lets you personalize their critical habitat license plate, ours pays tribute to both black-capped chickadees and blue jays. Imagine being able to honor my top two birds on the same license plate. I never had much of a relationship with either of my parents as an adult, but I definitely lucked out in the in-law department. When Russ's parents retired to Port Wing, Wisconsin in 1980, they immediately set up a feeding station, and my father-in-law took an instant dislike to blue jays. When a blue jay flies to a feeder, other birds instantly scatter, probably for the same reason that beginning birders at Hawk Ridge mistake blue jays for sharp-shinned hawks. In silhouette, both species have rounded wings and a long tail. And blue jays sometimes yell out a warning as if a predator was about. When the birds at the feeder scatter, in come the jays. But they're not really bullies at feeders. Once they settle down to eat, the jays are as peaceable as most other birds. You can tell they have their aggression turned down when their crests are down. My father-in-law and I ragged each other endlessly about blue jays, me calling them nature's perfect birds, and him saying how much he hated them. On his birthday in August 1987, I started my For the Birds program talking about how wonderful blue jays are, but said how even whispering their name would ruin his birthday, so I better talk about bald eagles instead. He got a big kick out of that. That Christmas, Russ and I made a poster with a large picture of a blue jay with a red circle slash over it saying, "Port Wing Blue Jay Haters, Elwood Erickson President," which he loved so much he immediately hung it in a place of honor in the hallway. Blue jays figured even more prominently in Erickson family life after I started rehabbing. The most memorable experiences for my kids and Russ happened the summer some Hermantown people brought me four very young nestling blue jays after their nest tree crashed to the ground in a thunderstorm. I'll save those stories for next time. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
Those blue jays are loud. So are the red-winged blackbirds. They just kind of, their volume level, those two, in our house at least. But, you know, it's okay. We have a little, we got a little finch feeder this year that's got suction cups to the window.
Oh.
And so we can look at that in the living room. And it's not very big. And there's a pair of finches that come. They're really cute. But a blue jay comes. Blue jays feel like a kind of a bully, and they look like six times as big as the finches, of course.
For sure.
They can barely fit in the thing, but they're there.
They're not heavy enough to, like, knock it down?
No.
Mm-mm. That's good.
No, it's working, so here we go. Birds, I mean, we don't have that long with birds, so we got to enjoy them now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we have some birds all winter, but you know, the ones we wait for all spring, they're here now, and it's time to, enjoy them.
Mm-hmm. It's Monday morning. Thanks for being here on People Powered KAXE. Coming up, we're going to hear an essay from musician Sam Miltich.
Heidi, our question of the week is about the 4th of July and traditions that you look forward to. We'd love to hear from you. You can text in 218-326-1234. Maybe it's something you always want to eat.
I always wear red, white, and blue.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, maybe it's, you know, you grill something. It's watermelon. It's, you know, what do you do?
It's fun to get kind of those, you know, brats day or, you know, cook out and do that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We had a family reunion once, a big one at my parents' house on the 4th, which was kind of fun.
Yeah.
It seemed kind of weird to do that, to gather all the, because most of our relatives did not. None of our relatives lived in Brainerd. They all lived in the Twin Cities. But it was a lot of fun. And we bought, I remember my dad, I was an adult when we did it. My dad and I kind of ran it and got all the red, white, and blue decorations. And
yeah. It was
very exciting. So, yeah, fun times. And you have that tradition. Do you run into people from your growing up years?
Yeah,
and
sometimes.
Neighbors and
so I go to my hometown of Spicer, which always does it up big for the 4th, and the parade is in the morning and it lines up on my parents' block.
Oh, perfect.
So it's like this, you know, usually quiet little street, and my early memories of it are being woken up. They would use like a hammer to pound these stakes into the ground because they had to put like the numbers of each float, like, so people knew where to go. And I just remember every 4th being woken up to ding, 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 ding. They'd be pounding these stakes into the ground. Now, of course, they just use like little metal things that, you know, they just slide into the ground. So it's not, I don't wake up to that noise, but there's still like, it's a golf cart driving around putting out all these little flags. So you hear that. And then all of a sudden, like, things just kind of start happening, and then it's this just big hub of activity.
People put the chairs out early, right?
Yep, that down, but that's, you know, down toward the lake. And then, then we walk through all this activity to get to those chairs that my dad is always so nice to put out as soon as he gets up, as long as it's not raining or storming. And then, and then we watch the parade and then come back, and then everything just quiets down, and it's it's so different. But
were you ever in the parade?
Yes, plenty of times.
Okay.
I was in a community band that played sometimes. My neighbors had a hardware store, so sometimes I'd get recruited into being on their float and you know, doing that stuff. So
there you go. Let us know. We want to hear about your 4th of July traditions. You can text us 218-326-1234. We receive support from Headwaters Music and Arts in downtown Bemidji, announcing the Headwaters Fiddle Camp, inviting youth and adult string musicians with at least 1 year of playing experience for a week of music, learning, and community. Camp runs Monday through Friday, 9 to 4, July 20th through the 24th. Registration deadline July 14th. Available at headwatersmusicandarts.org or on Facebook and on Instagram.
Noted jazz musician Sam Miltich has been doing a deep dive into his family history, sharing what he's learned with family and friends. In this story told live at Clackow Brewing, he tells about his great-grandmother's losses and how they relate to his own. Here's Sam Miltich.
So sort of the genesis of all this was my great-grandmother. I wanted to know about my great-grandmother, and I didn't know much about her origins. My Miltich family was always like sort of front and center for me. And my Miltich family is, they were Croatian immigrants, and Croatian culture is somewhat paternal. So I was very focused on that side of my family. And the fact that they're my grandmother, who was not Croatian, was an only child, and my grandfather had 10 siblings, and my dad had 10 siblings, so the Miltiches just outnumbered everybody else. So I just wanted to sort of honor the female story because it sort of got overshadowed. I don't know if it was intentional, but it just did. The stories that I did hear about her life were a couple things. It was that she was always generous. It was that she was always kind. It was that she loved children. It was that she was an elementary school teacher, and she wanted to educate young kids, and that she was just a genuinely benign and benevolent person. The other stories that I heard about her was that she endured just some really terrible tragedies. The first of which was when she was a girl, she was born 1886. And in 1901, her father on their farm in central Minnesota was crushed in a threshing machine accident. So he was killed on the farm. So she first lost her father. The next thing that happened is her mother forbid her from going to school and said, you need to stay home and work on the farm. You're not going anywhere. And the next piece of that story was at, if you can believe it, age 14, she ran away from home so she could go to school. She was determined to get an education. So this was a young woman at the turn of the century who was bound and determined to be an educated woman and that she was going to educate others. She married my great-grandfather, and they had my grandmother, Jean. And the next piece that happened was my grandmother was an only child because she had a stillborn baby. And then shortly after that, her husband committed suicide, and she was left with just her and her child. So this was a woman who had to have courage to keep moving forward. I knew her as Mabel Geno. We pronounce the name Geno, spelled G-E-N-O-W. And she was born on March 12th, 1886, so that's 99 years to the day of my birth. The earliest spelling of the name that we have looks like Cheno, and in places like Poland and Ukraine, which is where our family came from, which I never knew, I would be pronounced as Genov or Chenov. And that family was married to a Jewish family from Galicia, Poland, with the name Onkel. None of this I knew. We never heard anything about the origins of the family. I never knew anything about it. We'd just say, where were they from? Well, they had a farm in central Minnesota. That was it. Well, where in Europe did they come from? Don't know. What language did they speak? Nobody knew. They didn't want to talk about it. So when I interviewed my grandmother's last remaining cousin, who was 90 years old, she said, all I know is the name was changed a bunch when they had to flee Europe. So the family was Eastern European, and I say they were too Jewish to be Polish, too Polish to be Jewish, and too Ukrainian to be anything else. And they did not fit neatly into any ethnic or religious box. One of the things that was fascinating, that was so intriguing to me, is there was no religious record of our family. And in fact, on the immigration papers that I studied, it actually said religion, none, that was listed, which is pretty rare for that time in history. I did know that they were very poor. They had a small farm in central Minnesota. This I did not know. I knew about the farm in central Minnesota, but my dad's great-grandfather had a farm up in far northwestern Minnesota in a Polish community, and he worked in a Ukrainian community that was just north across the border in the Red River Valley. So I had no idea that I had northern Minnesota heritage in the far northwestern corner. I knew about my heritage in the far northeastern corner on the Iron Range. They had an East Slavic last name, no religion listed. They could speak both Slavic and German languages, and they did not fit neatly into any community, and they always seemed to live on the margins of any community where they went. Even the landscape where they lived was what was called the Aspen Parkland, which is not great forestry, not great agriculture, so they were always living in these marginal communities. So this extended into places like the Volga region in Russia, the parklands of Canada and Minnesota. And they were never fully a part of any one of these communities. They sort of shifted between these various groups. But what I realized, as hard as it was for me to wrap my head around what their origins were, it was actually their diversity that helped them. It was their ability to live in a Slavic community or be part of a Jewish community or a German community. There certainly was a loss of identity because Genov turned to Geno when they came to America. But they did survive by their adaptation to culture. I always found a kind of strength in my grandfather's Croatian heritage from southeastern Europe, but it was always a very kind of harsh resilience and toughness, but I related to it. I realized that, like Mabel, I suffered terrible tragedies in my life as well. I lost my brother when I was 10 years old. I lost my home when I was 14. I lost my mind when I was 22. And I lost the use of my hearing in my left ear when I was 33. And as a musician, that was pretty challenging, I have to say. So I realized that I too contended with losses just like Mabel. So I've been an atheist at points in my life. I've been an agnostic at points in my life. And I've been a believer all at different times. When I lost my hearing, I would say fervently and desperately prayed that my hearing would come back, and that was not successful. I was completely consumed by grief and depression, and I thought what I loved most was gone, my musical life. And I came to the conclusion that there could be no benevolent creator if this was how this was going to turn out. How could I dedicate my life to music, survive schizophrenia, and then have this befall me? So I decided to read, I found Jewish heritage in my family. I decided to read Rabbi Harold Kushner's book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And he talked about being a kid and enjoying reading comic books. And so he loved the Superman comics. That was his favorite. And he said, the thing about Superman that made the comics so interesting was not the fact that Superman could do everything. So if the creator, if God is Superman and he can do anything, why can't he bring back my hearing? Why can't this happen, right? He realized where the intrigue in the story is in kryptonite. It's the kryptonite that creates the conflict. That creates the story, right? Kushner lost his son to a terrible genetic illness, and he came to the conclusion that if the creator is perfect and all-knowing and all-powerful and has created this creation, our world, planet Earth, the stars, the sun, those are all natural processes. That's nature. And because nature works in harmony, God can't suspend the laws of nature. So this was the kryptonite. This was my kryptonite. I couldn't suspend the laws of nature. The Creator couldn't suspend the laws of nature. I realized that I was looking for a supernatural fix to my loss. I wanted to pray to the Creator that my brother would come back, that my home would come back, that my hearing would return. And I thought, these are all supernatural. The real miracles are the natural. The real miracles are nature itself. It's miraculous that Matthew and I can go out and collect sap and boil water from a tree and get sugar. It's miraculous that food can grow on top of water. These are the miracles. And I realized I was praying for the wrong thing. I needed to pray for the natural miracle that me, myself, my spirit, my courage, I had the ability to adapt, that my hearing would not come back in this year, but that I could find a way to do this music with just one ear. And I figured Django Reinhardt's recordings are all in mono anyways, so what the heck? So my most sort of mature epiphany in my spiritual discovery was my natural ability to adapt. And that, you know, the creator is actually just the creation itself. It's the earth, which we are all a part of, every one of us. When I came to this conclusion, I could let go of the anger and the bitterness that I felt towards the creator for what I thought had taken this from me. No, the creator didn't take your hearing. A virus did. That's part of the natural world. It was a virus, not the creator. It's nature. We're mortal. We're humans, right? So I was able to let go of this anger and resentment and bitterness I felt. I realized that I had the ability to adapt and I could accept the realities of the natural world of loss, of death, but also of adaptability and resilience. I realized that, like my great-grandmother Mabel, I no longer held bitterness or anger, just the opposite. And she was caring and loving. She was also a wilderness canoe paddler. She was paddling the Boundary Waters in the 1910s, I think, with her husband. She was remarkable. So I always thought I had this kind of strength and resilience from my Croatian, you know, Southeastern European heritage. And I realized it was from the Eastern European heritage I never knew I had, which came from my great-grandmother. And I'm grateful that this resilience came from the feminine side of my Eastern European heritage, as well as the male. And I realize they're different, and they're both valid and unique in their own ways, and I can't have one without the other. It's like yin and yang, you know? And here's a fun little side note that I like. I realized as a part of this process, studying all the various branches of my family, that I might be related to everyone in our family friend circle. So I see Art and Karen back there. I might be related to you through the Quaker side of the family. I might be related to Gail through my Alsatian family from Alsace-Lorraine. I might be related to Scott through my Irish and Scottish side. I might be related to Frida through Galicia and Poland and Michael in Belarus and Ukraine. So we actually literally truly are all related. So that's my story of spirit and courage. Thank you very much.
That was Sam Miltich at a Stay Human storytelling event supported in part by an artist equity grant from the Arrowhead Regional Arts Commission with support from the McKnight Foundation and produced by Michael Goldberg.
That is Heidi Holton. I'm